Well, it's nice to see everybody here, and we'd like to welcome you all to Parshas Mishpatim 5765. This is the Parsha that deals with, or the one of them that introduces to us the Mishpatim, the laws of the Torah, laws mostly associated with the civil sphere, dealings between man and man, certain laws dealing with people's property, damages, theft, guardianship, and on and on, occasionally sprinkled with some of the ritual laws, such as the observing the three festivals and others. But when we think of Mishpatim, we think of the Torah's system of justice. And I'd like to start off with a line from Rashi, which gives us a very interesting entree into the nature of these Mishpatim. Rashi's starting point is one letter, the first letter of the Parsha, Vav. The Parsha begins, Ve'ele ha-mishpatim asher tasim lifnehem. And these are the ordinances. Ordinances will be our working definition of, or translation of, the word mishpatim, that you shall place before them. And these. Why and? Why not just these? Ele. We have the word ele quite commonly. I think that the book of Exodus begins with the word Eile. These. Let's see for sure. Beginning of... No, that's also Ve'ele. Never mind. Well, there must be a reason there too. But Eile, these, is a common word in the Torah. And if it says Ve'ele, then it means something different than Eile. So what is the difference between Eile and Ve'ele? So the first Rashi on the Parsha addresses this. Kol makom sheneemar ele, posal es harishonim. Any place where the Torah uses the word ele, it negates what has been previously stated. Meaning, not doesn't negate it totally. It means that what we have said before is not really connected with what we will say now. But ve ele mosif al harishonim. But if the term ve'ele is used, and these, then it is coming to add this to the words that were stated before. Well, what was... So here we're saying ve'ele ha-mishpatim, and these are the mishpatim. Well, this is the beginning of mishpatim. What is this connecting itself to? Well, so what was the ending of the latter part of the last week's parsha, Yisroel? Well, first we had before the first half was Moshe's father-in-law Yisroel suggesting a system of courts, but more recently was the Ten Commandments. Ten Commandments, where the Jews were stood around Mount Sinai and heard these ten statements from God transmitted through Moshe. So, the point of saying Ve'ele ha-mishpatim, and these are the Mishpatim, is to connect the Mishpatim with Har Sinai, with Mount Sinai. Rashi concludes and says, Maharishonim Sinai, just as the earlier laws, the Ten Commandments, were given and heard from Sinai, Mount Sinai, directly from God, Af Elu Sinai. The Mishpatim are also from Mount Sinai. And that is an important thing to bear in mind as you learn the Mishpatim. Apparently, it's worth an extra letter. It's important to know that the Mishpatim come from Sinai. Why is it so important to know that the Mishpatim come from Sinai? Why is it important to know that it was God who authored the law of murder and manslaughter and the killing of a slave and penalty for bodily injury or death caused by an animal or damage caused by a pit, an open sewer, open sewer which was not covered, an animal damaging property, one who steals livestock, self-defense, payment for theft, laws of guardians, borrowing, and then other perpetrations, seduction or rape. Rape is maybe not in this parsha, but it's related. Sensitivity to the helpless and abandoned, extending free loans, integrity of the judicial process, fair dispensation of justice, and on and on and on. Why do we have to know that that came from Sinai? And if it didn't, it's still very important. It's still crucial to have these laws in place. All societies that are considered themselves civilized will have a system of justice. So why does the Torah have to emphasize, before you begin, remember, ladies and gentlemen, remember that these are not just any mishpatim, these are mishpatim from God. These are mishpatim that were pronounced or handed from God to Moshe at Mount Sinai and passed on from generation to generation. Why is it so important for us to be aware of that fact as we study Mishpatim? That is the question on the floor. So I'd like to talk for a few moments about this question and share with you some insights that I learned from Rav Yerucham Levavitz, the revered teacher, Rebbe, of Musar, of Torah for the sake of personal growth and improvement and character development, who taught in the yeshiva of Mir in Poland in the 1920s and 30s. But the Sefer has been republished and it's spanking new. So that's our question. Why is it important for us to know that the laws of the Torah, particularly the Mishpatim, the civil laws, come from God? So he points out the difference between laws that are written by men and laws that are written by God. As we mentioned, these mishpatim would be found in any civilization, in any system of justice. Okay, so what's the difference? So I'd like to mention four, it's not just differences, what I'd like to really bring out is how do we look at Mishpatim differently because they were written by God? How does that change our approach? Okay, point number one. Laws that are written like men, by men, are as reliable as men. Men are fallible. Their laws are fallible. Men are sometimes contradictory. They sometimes say one thing and then they change their mind. You ask them a question, on one day the answer is blue, and the next day the answer is red, and the third day the answer is green. One day a man's in a good mood. Another day the man's in a sour mood. Well, laws that are written by men are also going to be like men. They are going to sometimes contradict one another. They are sometimes going to be paradoxical. They are sometimes going to reflect man's mood. They are sometimes going to reflect the waves of society. Laws will change because people change. Fashions change, fads change, and so their laws change. He says very, almost humorously, when one studies the Talmud, one is constantly making sure that one statement of the sages does not contradict another, and we will not rest until we've resolved the conflict. We don't necessarily do that in a legal system. We can't necessarily hold a human-based legal system to such precision. If you ask them, well, why did you make this ruling in this year and another rule the other year? The answer might just be, well, we forgot. Or that's how this judge saw it, but this is how I see it. Not necessarily, it may not necessarily be harmonious. So one thing we're dealing is the difference between a human-based system, which is at the best relative to man's state. Whereas when you're talking about a system made by God, you're talking about a system of laws which is absolute, which is as consistent, as solid, as just as God is. It is perfect as God is perfect. There can be nothing that's contradictory or conflicting or unfair or inconsistent. It can't be, because it originates from a source which is infallible. This is our first point of awareness when we enter into a system of laws, mishpatim, that's based on God, not based on man. A corollary of this, point number two, is that, and we've kind of already mentioned it, is the fact that unlike laws which may change, the Torah will never change. The Torah can't change because it doesn't depend on anything social or anything in society. It originates from the true, pure source of God. God doesn't depend on the time and the place of society. It doesn't depend on people. So even though our values, internal, or society's values may change, the Torah's laws are going to still be the same. There's no such thing as modernizing the law. You can perhaps apply the law to modern situations. If man, using technology or using further study, discovers a new way of doing a certain process, using a machine, using a computer, using communication or travel or something, you may say, wow, the Torah's law, we never applied it to that situation, let's see how it applies. But the principle of the law will be the same. It's just a question of applying. Whereas human law might actually change. It used to be that people thought that abortion was like killing, but now they don't see it that way. See, that's something that you would find in a human system. Torah will never change. So, are Jewish people old-fashioned? Depends what you call old-fashioned. Does the Torah? Yes, the Torah doesn't change. Does the Torah adapt to modern society? Absolutely. An application, not in the principle. So that's another point. The immutability, the unchanging nature of the laws of the Torah. Now, there is the next two points are a little bit more subtle and a little bit more profound. We mentioned that the Torah does not depend on the world, does not depend on man, certainly, because it originated from the source. Let's think about that. Let's take that and carry it to its logical conclusion. And out of this analysis comes something that is likely to blow your mind. Likely to blow your mind. So hold on to your head. Make sure that it doesn't spin away. The Torah doesn't depend on man. Is that right? That means the mitzvahs don't depend on man. Well, how could that be? Let's take an example. The mitzvah of celebrating Passover. Okay? Why is there a mitzvah to celebrate Passover? Why is there a mitzvah to bring the paschal lamb, to eat matzah, to eat bitter herbs, to tell the story of the Exodus? Why is there such a mitzvah? If I open up my Haggadah, I will read it's a mitzvah to eat the Paschal lamb, because in Egypt, God passed over the houses of the Hebrews and smote the firstborn of the Egyptians. And why do we eat the matzah? Because that was the bread of freedom as we left Egypt. The bread didn't rise. Why do we eat the maror? Because the Egyptians enslaved us, etc. Right? Let's say the Egyptians hadn't enslaved us. Let's say there was no Exodus. Let's say there was no bitter slavery. So would there not have been those mitzvahs? Logically, it seems that there would not have been. If the Egyptians hadn't enslaved us, there shouldn't be a mitzvah to observe Passover. But we just said that the laws of the Torah don't depend on man. They come from God. But isn't that paradoxical? God saw what man did. God saw the machinations of the Egyptian regime. And he says, uh-oh, we better add some mitzvahs here, because I want the Jews to remember this. That means God had to create a mitzvah because of man's decisions. That conflicts our whole premise. Okay, hold on to your head. We do not observe the mitzvah of Passover because the Egyptians enslaved us and God freed us. We observe the mitzvah of Passover because God ordained in the Torah, which pre-existed the creation of the world, because the Torah is in God's mind. In fact, Zohar tells us that God looked into the Torah, and with the Torah in mind, he created the world. Which means, you're holding on to your heads? Which means that God ordained that the Jewish people should observe the mitzvahs of Passover, and therefore he created the scenario of the Egyptian slavery and the Exodus so that we would have a context to celebrate Passover. I see everybody's head is still on. Let's take another example. There is a mitzvah of honoring our parents. One of the Ten Commandments, one of the most important mitzvahs. Why does God want us to honor our parents? After all, our parents, they got together and they created us, right? They were like partners in creation with God. They created us. I mean, that's a lot of giving, a lot of goodness that they created for us. They gave us the opportunity to have life. We ought to thank them. We ought to respect them. We ought to honor them. Look what they've done for us. We should do everything that we can for them. Right? Well, that means that, again, it sounds like the mitzvah is reacting to human beings. Because the parents decided to have the child, therefore God said in a reactive way, now that they have given birth to you, you are obligated to pay them back and honor them. Once again, it sounds like the mitzvah depends on the person. That conflicts our premise. God doesn't create mitzvahs to react to the world, to react to man. The mitzvahs are absolute. The mitzvahs are originated from God's mind. So the conclusion is, the logical conclusion is, that God wanted Jewish people to have a mitzvah of honoring their parents. But you can't do that mitzvah unless there's parents. So God decided that people should be created through parents so that there could be a mitzvah of honoring them. I don't see the heads rolling. See, what difference does it make? This sounds great and philosophical, but what that means that, or another one, a favorite one, tzedakah. Why is there a mitzvah of tzedakah? Because the poor man doesn't have any money. Well, when he comes and asks me for tzedakah, I'm logically going to start thinking about whether he really deserves it. What do you mean you don't have the money? Why don't you have the money? Did you get a job? Why should I worked hard for my money? Why should I give my money to you? Wait a minute. Did God tell us to give him money because he needs it? You're making the mitzvah depend on man. You're saying that if he would have had more money, then I wouldn't have had to give him the money. So that means he's the cause of the mitzvah. And I choose to deny him or argue with him. But that conflicts our premise. Our premise is that the mitzvahs don't depend on people. So what's the logical conclusion? You hear it already. God wanted there to be a mitzvah of tzedakah. God wanted people to share their resources with others. Therefore, he created poor people. For me to argue with him is like me arguing with God. God, you shouldn't have even given such a mitzvah. Or for me to say, well, why should I be so respectful to my parents? They didn't treat me well. I'm like saying to God, I don't like this mitzvah. Wait a minute. The mitzvah is the whole reason you have the parents. If this mitzvah wasn't so important, God would have created you without parents. Don't worry. He has no problem doing that. He did it to Adam and Eve. So, therefore, the mitzvah is the primary focus. Honoring them is the goal, not the means. It's not reactive. It's not that I have to honor them because of what they did to me, because then I could say they didn't do so much for me, which isn't true, by the way, but I could rationalize within my mind that maybe this mitzvah isn't so well placed here. But if I say that God created the parents so that I could fulfill this mitzvah, then that argument doesn't even start. And the argument doesn't start with the poor. And the argument... Now, that doesn't mean that the mitzvahs don't have guidelines. I could, you know, if a poor man comes to me and I look up and I'm very well versed with the laws of tzedakah. And the laws of tzedakah say that God only expects you to give this amount and only to people that have these qualifications, etc., then God built that into the system. But as far as philosophically, you know, arguing with the concept of the mitzvah, I'm really approaching the mitzvahs backwards. So that's why we have to know that the mitzvahs come from Sinai. If they came from man, then they are reactive to society. If they came from God, then the society is just a reflection of God's will, creating the environment such that we can perform these mitzvahs, because these mitzvahs are things that we need for our completion. It's a different orientation altogether. One more point, which is a subtle point, but also very profound, is that whereas a system which is man-made was pieced together, all different rulings, all different laws created by different needs. One year, you know, when we started off, our Constitution had 10 articles, right? With the passage of time, we added three more, right? The next century, we added 15 more. I don't know. But they're all really separate. There's really no inherent connection between one and the other, because they were all added reactive to the situation. So one cannot really necessarily look at them as a unified, symbiotic whole. Whereas the mitzvahs of the Torah, because they originate from the absolute source of God, therefore they are totally harmonious. They are totally harmonious. Just like the limbs of a body, the human being was created by God. The finger is connected. I know the song goes that this bone is connected to this bone, but really, this finger is connected to my ear. Why? Because it's all part of a holistic system. if my if one organ isn't working, then it's going to create a an imbalance in another organ. And of course, the most important organ, the heart, is going to control everything. Just as there's a symbiotic relationship in the various parts of the human body, there is a symbiotic relationship between one mitzvah and another mitzvah. Now, this has incredible ramifications. By the way, this analogy to between the mitzvahs and the human body is not just a casual one. How many positive mitzvahs are there in the Torah? 248. How many limbs in the body? 248. Doctors, if we're limbs, we'll have to discuss. Limbs, four? Well, we're talking about the bones. Like this, the foot has 30, right? Joints, okay. Evarim, it's what's called, the sages use the term evarim, which I guess in English is loosely translated as limbs. But there is a Mishnah which lists the bones, and it comes out to 248. Is that right?
I believe so.
Okay. Thank you, doctor. Anyway, 248 positive mitzvahs, 248 limbs of the body. Coincidental? If you're not convinced, how many negative commandments?
345.
365, the sages say, is the number of gidim, sinews, ligaments in the body, tendons. I have a tendency to misquote this, but again, there is a correlation between the mitzvahs and the human body. That means the mitzvahs is also a body. That means mitzvahs are not just independent things. They are part of a symbiotic whole. The implications of that are enormous. Remember the story when the convert came in front of Hillel, and he told Hillel, "Teach me the entire Torah while I stand on one foot." Previously, he had gone to Shammai, and Shammai says, "If you want it so quick, I can't possibly teach you the entire Torah on one foot. The Torah is vast. You have to commit yourself to lifelong study." Hillel had a different approach. He said, "Okay, I'll tell you one thing that is the root of the Torah, and everything else derives from it. What is hateful unto your fellow, do not do. No, what is hateful unto you, do not do to your fellow." Now, how could that be? He says, that's the entire Torah, the rest is commentary. How could that be? It's just one principle. The Torah is filled with hundreds and hundreds of principles. Yes, but let's say I was a doctor, and you came to me and you said, "Doctor, give me a ticket for good health." And I would say, "Take care of your heart." Would you say, "But doctor, that's only one organ. How am I going to take care of my fingers? How am I going to take care of my eyes and my ears and my teeth?" If you take care of your heart, you will have good health in your other extremities as well. See, you can do that with something which is a symbiotic whole. You could not do that with any other system of laws. But the Torah is one whole. And so Hillel could say that if you treat other people the way you would like to be treated yourself, you will find good health in terms of all the other commandments of the Torah. Because that's like the vital organ. That's one of the benefits, the ramifications of the fact that the laws of the Torah are from God. We can go around and simplify things and say something like, like Hillel said, treat others like you would treat yourself. And we can say with confidence, you will become observant and religious of the entire Torah. And we can say something like, have faith in God. Tzadik be'amunaso yechia, one of the prophets said, the righteous man lives through his faith in God. We can say something like that because it is part of a symbiotic whole. There are vital organs within the mitzvos that lead and give life and sustenance to the other organs as well. That's only possible because it comes from God. So this really sheds light on the topic which we had a few weeks ago, that Rav Yerucham said that everything depends on the heart. You know, this is like tying into that. We talked about how everything that we do, everything that we think, is really somehow a manifestation of our heart health, our spiritual heart. I'd like to just, in the closing minutes, share with you something that I discovered from a different sefer, which I thought was very, very revealing. We talked about the concept of having a healthy heart, but what exactly, is there some kind of a checklist that one could see whether their heart is healthy? I think I found such a checklist in the Sefer Chovos Halvavos. This is a much, much older Sefer, written by one of the Rishonim in the 13th century, 14th century, Abenu Bachayai Ibn Pakuda. It was written in Arabic. It was translated into Hebrew, in a difficult Hebrew. It was retranslated recently into a lighter Hebrew. Anyway, this is a sefer which Chovos Halavavos means duties of the heart. And it goes through various topics in a progressive way, explaining of so many obligations and mitzvahs that have to do with just internal, what we believe, what we think, and how that's really at the root of everything. There was one particular topic that I've been studying with a friend called Shar HaBechina, the gate of reflection. Reflection means to reflect on the wonders and the works of Hashem, of the Creator. The contention of the author is that if a person would be totally aware, cognizant, and appreciative of everything that Hashem did for him and for the world, he would be overflowing with the desire to give back and to serve God in the best way he could possibly do. And any lack of our doing so, any lack of our observing and giving to God what he expects of us, is due to the lack of reflection that we have in what God has done for us. And so he writes a whole treatise on how to appreciate everything in the world. You know, from the way a person is created, the way that God orchestrated so perfectly and so precisely the growth of a baby and how it gets its nourishment, and how the mothers, he says, that the mothers, the blood that brings nourishment through the umbilical cord into the uterus is converted into the milk that then nourishes the baby right after it's born, and all the perfection of the human body, and then the human mind, and then going out into the world, and how people interact with each other, how there's certain universal things that people just accept, even though they make no sense whatsoever, such as the value of money. He says that's a miracle, that everybody accepts the value of money, even though you can't do anything with it. It's absolutely not functional. And he goes on, and just page after page, look, you would be constantly dazzled by the wonderful miracles of God every moment, and that would lead us to serving him. So at the very end, after he describes all these wonders, which he says is only just starting to scratch the surface, he says, so why aren't people more reflective? Why don't people have greater appreciation? He says, I'll tell you the reasons why people don't sit and have this awesome reflection and appreciation for God all the time. It could be one of the following things. And when I read this list, I said, this is the list of good spiritual heart health. Because it's not intellectual. It's really kind of what makes us tick. So I'd like to just review that list with you, and I think I wanted to share this with you as soon as I read it, but I do think that it fits in to our topic. Five things. Actually, extra two. 5 to 7 things. Number one, a lack in the emunas hayichud, the belief in oneness. Oneness is a very important concept in Judaism. Hashem Echad, God is one. Oneness. That has several aspects. Number one, God is one. There is only one power, one source of existence. Sometimes we believe in God, but we also believe in other things. That is a lack of oneness. We believe in God, but we also believe in humans, in human power, as a separate source. Or we also believe in chance, or luck, or something like that. Anytime we ascribe power to something other than God, in addition to God, we're not talking about a denier. We're not talking about a person who's an atheist, who doesn't even accept God. We're talking about somebody who accepts God, but not the total oneness of God. There is going to be a detraction from our amazement and our reflection on God's work. Also, when there's a lack of oneness in our intent. If we are motivated to serve God, but we're also motivated for other things, such as honor, reward, things that are self-serving, it's also going to detract from our full embrace and reflection upon God. That's also a lack of oneness. Another lack of oneness is the separation between the spiritual and the physical. When we see the spiritual and the physical as one whole, the physical enabling the spiritual, we are totally in sync with the service of God. When we see the physical as taking away from the spiritual, then we have a problem. Then we are split. We're split personalities. Yes, sometimes I want to be spiritual, but now I just want to be physical. Rather than seeing that physicality is part of the spiritual life, that also requires oneness. So that's all part of one general category, emunas hayichud, belief in the power of one. And by the way, I think we also have another illustration of that oneness, talking about the oneness of mitzvahs. But, okay. So that's general category number one of five. Category number two, which detracts us, which keeps us from reflection, is we're too busy. We're too busy. We're so involved in worldly matters that we don't have time to think about what's really important, to think about God, to think about where we're going. Constantly chasing after vanities. I'm not talking about the physical drives. I'm just talking about the involvement, not taking time to reflect. Which, by the way, was the whole intent of Paro. Paro, keep the Jews busy working. When they started to say, could we go out? We want to go to the desert and serve our God. Oh, you're not busy enough. He increased the workload because he knew this. He knew that people who are too busy don't make time for God. That's number two. Number three, we become too accustomed to all of the great goodnesses that God has given us. We become used to it. Yes, it's wonderful that I wake up every morning and I can stand up and I can see and I can breathe. But it happens every day. I just forget about it. It's just a habit. That's a problem. And that's, you know, the sages have instituted blessings so that we force ourselves to take stock and count our blessings. Thank you, God, for our mind. Thank you for our eyes. Thank you for our bones, for our spine, for our feet, for our ability to walk, etc., etc. But not to take off time. We're going to become habituated. That's number three. Number four. When things happen to a person, what can be categorized as yisurim, suffering. A person doesn't believe that they came upon him with just cause and for his good. He therefore has complaints against God who made them happen. That's a big one. That's number four. I don't accept that God is doing what he's doing to me for my good, or that I deserve them. If you are the, if you're the one that's making the lawsuit against God, you're not going to be so favorably impressed and taken by all the things that you do for him, that he does for you, because you have gripes. This is number four. A person, on the other hand, who says, whatever God does is just. And I don't know why, but I believe that there's a good reason, and ultimately, it's for my good. Use the analogy of the child. The parent has to sometimes chastise the child. The child is sore. But when the child gets older, he realizes that it was for his own good. So we can do that too. We can also have that kind of a reaction rather than a reaction of complaining and griping. But if we are complaining and griping, it's going to be a major blockage into our arteries and heart health. Number five, gava, arrogance. And the arrogance is expressed this way, simply. You know why I'm not so impressed and so appreciative of all the things that God did for me? Because I deserve them. I have them coming to me. Why should I be so appreciative? Oh, really? God owes you. That's gava. That's conceit. You think God owes you? You're not going to be appreciative then. God doesn't owe you anything. He didn't have to create you. So, everything is a gift. Instead of saying, what don't I have? Say, what do I have? Everything is a gift. These are some five things. I was very, very impressed by this. Because these are things which, these are not intellectual things. These are the way we feel. This is our heart. When we wake up in the morning, right, we can have a yichud attitude. Everything is one. God is one. My intention is focused. I see everything as serving a purpose, part of the spiritual path. Oneness. That's heart healthy. I realize that we live in a world with a lot of hustle and bustle, but I know that I need to make time for God, for spirituality. I know that this is vital to my health.
God created Shabbos.
That's right. Excellent. Very good. At least one day a week,
yes,
we do that. Excellent. Yasher Koach. I will not take for granted, even though things happen so often. He's constantly showering upon me kindnesses day after day. Every day I'm going to appreciate. If something happens that is painful, that is shocking, that is startling, I'm going to think about it. It's happening for my good. God doesn't do anything that's not for our good. And everything that he does is just. And he's a master accountant. And whatever I lose in this world, I will certainly gain 10 times more in the next world. Or I will gain in this world. It will make me more of a reflective person. It will make me grow. It will bring me merit. So I don't complain to God. I thank God for everything that happens because it's all for the best. And the fifth thing is, I don't have anything coming to me. I can't afford not to be appreciative of what God has given me because I really don't deserve anything. I think these points, these 5 points, would fill in for us the missing gap of what does it mean to have a healthy heart. And apparently, if we have good heart health, everything else flows from there. Knowledge, understanding, relationships, a happy and a productive life. So, in Emirat Hashem, we should take, once again, just from a little point, a word, ve'ela. We have a Rashi, we have an insight from Rav Yerucham. We're building a lot from a little, but it's all part of this complete whole, and may we take these words to heart, and may our hearts grow stronger. And with if we make a little improvement in any of these areas, there's no telling what a great impact that has on our life. A little bit more appreciation, a little bit more focus, oneness, a little bit more taking a little bit more time out of our busy days, a little bit more humility. There's no telling how far these things can take us in our health and in our spiritual growth. Yes, questions?
Say that the Torah was given before the creation of the world?
Not given. But it was, it may not have been written on paper, but the Torah is from God, and God was, is, and always will be, and so therefore the Torah is as timeless, shall we say. It's not a question of how old it is, it's timeless, just as God is timeless, because the Torah comes from God.
Bless you.
It's out of this world, so to speak.
Who said the premise that mitzvahs don't depend on man? You started that and then gave the example. Who actually?
Oh, well, it's just a corollary of the notion that the laws don't come from man, the laws come from God. And as such, it predates the world. As such, it can't be dependent. They're not reactive to anything that happened in the world. Yeah, let me take Dr. Appelruth and then Dina. Yeah. The question is, why did God entrust in man and the rabbis to be the interpreters of the Torah if the Torah was perfect? This exactly is a very good question. Do you know who asked this question first? The angels. On Mount Sinai, the angels called a meeting, an emergency meeting, and they said, we want to speak to God. And they asked God this question. He said, God, this Torah predates the world. How can you give it into the hands of human beings? They're going to schlep it to the ground. They're going to step on it. Right? How can you do that? They asked this question that you're asking right now. God did not answer their question. He asked Moshe to answer the question. And Moshe realized that only he could answer it because he was representing the recipient. So God said to Moshe, grab onto my throne and give the angels an answer. So Moshe says, he grabs onto the throne. Each nuance has to be understood. And he says to the angels, would you like the Torah instead of us? They said yes. We are perfect. Give us the Torah. Moshe said, okay, let's see what's in the Torah. It says, I'm the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt. So he says to the angels, were you ever in Egypt? Were you rescued? Were you redeemed by God? And they said, no. So he said, how could this Torah be for you? How could this mitzvah be for you? It doesn't pertain to you. And then he went on. What else does it say? Remember the Shabbos day and keep it holy. Refrain from work. Angels, do you work?
How about kashrus?
Yeah, that's not in the commandments, but Ten Commandments, but... And they said no. And they said, well, how could Shabbos be for you? What need do you have for Shabbos? Shabbos is for people that are working and forget that God runs the world a whole week. Kabeda savicha v'yasimecha, honor your parents. Angels, do you have parents? Do you have jealousy that you need to be told not to murder, not to, to commit adultery, not to covet? In other words, they heard the answer. The answer was that of course the Torah has to be given to imperfect human beings, because that's the purpose of the Torah. To take imperfect human beings and have them reach up and grab onto the divine chair. In other words, it is worth it. It was the whole plan of God to create the Torah and create imperfect human beings so that we could raise ourselves and thereby grab onto the divine within us. And so he endowed us with the abilities of becoming very, very developed. He gave us very, very strict guidelines. He says, if you want to interpret this Torah, you have to be a scholar, a saint, right? You have to be somebody that is scrutinized, that has to present the text in front of students, that have every right to challenge you on every point. You have to be put through a test to make it onto the Sanhedrin, or whatever the body may be. It's subject to scrutiny by the entire body, and then voted on, etc., etc. And there's such strict guidelines that it forces man to be at a very high level in order to participate in that process. And this is how what God does is he creates the Torah and he brings it down to an imperfect world in order to raise the people up. Tina, yeah. This.
When you mentioned that you don't believe in sin, what came into my mind was the times of these natural catastrophes, or when God let loose the angel of death is on, and isn't it true that in cases like that, then some people who happen to be in certain situations will be affected, even though they, it wasn't the will of God that they, you know what I'm trying to say.
Well, first of all, like in that case with the angel of death, he told Moshe to tell everyone to stay in the houses.
If
they had gone out of the house, then it would have been their choice to go into a dangerous situation. And let's say a situation where a catastrophe happens that seems to take the innocent with the guilty.
Right, and I thought I was told that if sometimes once the catastrophe is going to happen, then some people will just happen to be.
Right. So that's not so much that it's chance. That is the way God chooses to conduct his affairs, and that gets into area number four, which is, do we believe that justice ultimately will be served? In other words, for example, the people who were we call the karbanos, the sacrifices in the Holocaust, right? Or what do the writings say about such people? Anyone like that is given the greatest position in the world to come, that kind of a thing. That ultimately, everything is just and fair, even though we don't understand it ourselves.
Yeah.
That's not. I wouldn't call that chance. That is God's. The way He works. Yeah.
You said that man was fallible. God was infallible.
Yeah.
What about when God originally intended for us to be like eat no meat? And then he changed his mind, so to speak, and then after the flood said we could eat.
Is that like changing the Torah? First, they weren't allowed to eat meat, and then they were. It sounds like God is changing to fit man. Okay, but our whole premise was that even if people change, the laws don't change.
What?
Right?
That was the premise.
Someone had brought up that subject when
these are one saying this is kosher, now first it wasn't kosher, now it's kosher.
Maybe we were at a higher level beforehand.
Okay, but then our whole premise falls away. Because I could say, well, we only had to keep these mitzvahs when we were on a higher level. Now we're not such a high level.
Yeah.
But that's why we were at a higher level, so we could do kavanot. Now we're not.
I know, but it's
right. But it's mitzvah still there. In other words, whenever there's a temple, we have to bring the karbanot.
Right, but we don't merit that, so the laws don't apply because we lost the Beit HaMikdash.
They still apply.
They still apply.
Those laws, the karbanot, don't apply. We can't do them.
We can't do them. It doesn't mean it was changed. Here he's giving an example of where first God said, you're not supposed to eat meat. Then he said, okay, you can eat meat.
Yeah, that's my
question.
Different person.
The law is always like that. If we were ever
okay. But the corollary is
so he's saying
God was a stern God. It was Elohim. It was Elohim, and then it was Hashem. So it's. That was his intention.
Well,
he didn't say that. It was in, we learned that it was his intention. Then.
He said, "You can eat from the tree."
Mm-hmm.
That implies that you need permission before you can eat something, and he only gave permission for the fruit. And then after the flood, then he said to Noah, now you can eat the animals.
But he did it because of something, though.
Because there was a change. I agree with you. Yeah, it was a change in man. Avinger is saying that there is a contingency built in, just as there are certain laws for certain people. A Kohen, for example, is allowed to eat certain sacrificial foods and others are not. There are also restrictions for some people and not others. God may have ordained that in the state that man was at the beginning and then before the flood, that he was on such a level that he was not allowed to eat meat. But the contingency was that if man would drop to a different level, then he would be allowed to eat meat. It's just that it revealed itself in different stages in the world. But God didn't really change any of the rules.